we don't actually check the tree's collision with the player's collision. We check the grid space that the tree is on, because the tree has just said, hey, you can't walk here.
You can't go here, buddy.
Hey, I'm tree in here.
Butterscotch
shenanigans. Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 115 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast, Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and I can be anything I want to
be. I'm Sam, and I'm just doing my
best. And today is September 11, 2017. Before we get started, we have a warning. Anything can happen on this show. There's going to be profanity. And then we're going to talk about adult-oriented topics.
Like really tall things, you know, things that only adults can use.
Mutual funds.
Roller coasters.
Mutual funds
roller
is a good
coasters.
One. Yeah, because although I think you can be a large child and still, but I guess you could be a large child
are
in
we all
this podcast
not
too.
All just large
An
children.
Adult
or
are
is
we all
large
small
child.
Adults? Who knows?
I don't know.
What we got for news? Let's talk about the news this week. We announced our next game. It's called Scuffle Buddies.
Yep, there it is.
We announced it last week. Do you want to talk about?
Yeah, let's talk about it real quick.
The announcement. Like, what was our intention? How did it go?
So the intention here is that we know that we totally messed it up a lot with the Crashlands stuff.
How did we announce Crashlands?
So Crashlands, we wrote a blog post. Yeah, and that may have been. I think I may have sent an email to maybe a person.
And the reason that we're doing this,
I know a lot of people are like, what's the game about? Well, you just have to wait, because part of the reason that we're doing it slow like this is because our dev is extremely iterative. And what that means is there's certain parts of it that while we know sort of the broader points, aside from maybe giving a broad genre point at this juncture, we can't do anything else. Because we might accidentally say something that doesn't actually exist in the game.
But so, also by providing a broad genre, then it implies a whole bunch of stuff in y'all's brains that
we don't want to be beholden to.
We don't
want to
be tied down to what everybody else thinks.
You can't constrain this.
Nope.
You can't put this in a box.
We're like fucking game Houdini.
That's right.
Game Houdini.
Once you uncork it from the bottle.
You can't put it
back.
That's a genie.
That's a genie, right.
A game genie, which is also a hacking device for the Game Boy back in the 1990s.
And we're talking about game Houdini.
Which also is a 3D modeling program.
It is. It's very neat. It's very cool.
This is getting very confusing.
Yeah. All right, anyway.
So the question is, what is this game? Well, we're not going to talk about it yet.
But we've had a lot of fun watching people's conjectures from the logo, which is designed specifically to be able to make conjectures from.
Otherwise, we would have just put it in sort of Helvetica black font.
I was thinking Comic Sans with a black outline white, you know, that sort of really.
What about yellow on white? That's the classic Comic Sans sort of configuration.
Yeah. So the announcement went very well. We ended up getting press from both Touch Arcade and PC Gamer, and then as well as a Kick My Geek, which is a French site, which then got picked up on Jeux Vidéo, which is their big video gaming site in France.
I love that the site is called Kick My Geek, because when I first heard that, I thought, this has to be a mistake. And I went, I was like, no, they're running with it.
Yeah,
that's their
good.
Thing.
And so we did end up getting a good amount of press, and the newsletter has been rolling out. And so there's an important note here, which you might not have gotten the newsletter yet. Like, it's not done running, correct?
No, it's still, we're about 90,000 emails deep. Which means we still have about 50,000 to go.
So
we could crank it up a notch, but I feel pretty good about this.
The faster we send emails, the more likely they go to spam.
Yeah.
Right. And this is an important thing to note, because we had some people asking or saying, oh, you know, I got the email about it already, but I did not get the email about it, but I heard it on this. You know, I thought it was supposed to be the newsletter was for special people only, and it's true. But the problem is that if we warm up our email servers too fast, they catch on fire, and then we're not allowed to send emails. So this is the result.
And even still, we haven't actually used it for a long time.
That's exactly it.
And as a consequence, I think I'm pretty sure we're already like kind of in spam trappy territory, because our open rate is lower than
usual.
Than usual,
and it's not usually because of anything we do. Most of you guys actually really like our emails, so it tends to be when we're going.
Yeah. So here's the irony of this: is the fewer emails we send, the more likely we get counted as a spammer.
I never thought about that.
Right? I mean, we have to send emails literally constantly.
Well, because it's all about consistency.
Right.
So no matter how many you send, as long as you do that consistently.
If we sent 30 emails a day to each person in our newsletter system, we would not be spammers as long as we just did
as
that every day.
As long as people opened them.
Right.
Sometimes.
Right.
Not that much, really.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting wrinkle to the whole thing. But we had a bunch of hilarious things happen on announcement. And we've talked on the podcast a bunch about, you know, there's no such thing as a good launch. And we prepped for this thing for weeks on the PR side. And then for, I think, a week and a half on the tech side.
So yeah, it's exactly 1 week on the tech side.
So Thursday.
It doesn't seem like much because it's just, here's the name of the game. Mm-hmm. And that's like, it seems like on the surface, that's the extent of it.
Right. But there's a lot going on under the hood. Yeah.
Well, because what we needed to do was make it so that people could sign up for a newsletter. Mm-hmm. Which sounds really easy because if you've never had to build that and don't know what the tech is on the back end, and even if you've used one, you've probably used it on like, I don't even know.
MailChimp,
Google Forms. Yeah, something where you just put a form on a thing and then somehow you just get to see in the back what came
usually
out of
you get
it.
A spreadsheet.
Yeah, you get like a spreadsheet.
But we're looking at potentially collecting thousands of email addresses.
Yeah.
And
we need to integrate these with our existing systems. And so we should do this ourselves. We're going to homebrew it. And it is actually very easy just to put up a form and collect email addresses. You can do that in mere moments, which I did do forever ago when we announced Crashlands. Or no, mm-hmm. when we greenlit Crashlands and put up the announcement for that. And as a consequence, we got hit by some spammer that then flooded our forum with tens of thousands of email addresses. And so now we're trying to be more mature.
So yeah, trying to have a secure system.
Yeah.
And it turns out that, as we've talked about in the podcast before, there's a lot of costs. It's very easy to do most things.
Security creates complexity.
It's just that because people are kind of dicks, then it takes a lot more time.
It
only takes one. So
if we have 10,000 signups that are legit and then one person comes in mm-hmm. and floods our server with 20,000 fake emails, mm-hmm. then everything's broken.
Yeah. So this is the one story I'll tell, which is the funny one, I think, the funniest one, which is that because of that spam bot, that Russian spam hacker thing happened with Crashlands, Adam put together a thing called a rate limiter. And what this allows us to do is just say, like, are you requesting too many email addresses? Mm-hmm. That's it. And if so, then
stop it.
We're not going to let you do that anymore.
Yep.
So when the site went live at 10 a.m., we'd mm-hmm. all been refreshing the site a bunch, as well as I had been sending a bunch of test emails through to make sure that I was able to sign up for the emails. And right at 10, as the TetraCade article went out, as all of our scheduled things posted on various places automatically, and we started getting a big bulk of traffic to the site, I got an error from putting in my email address. And mm-hmm. it just had some cryptic, like, oh, sorry, this doesn't work right now. And I yelled across the table, said, Adam,
why
does this not work right now? And uh-huh. he's like, well, you've been refreshing the page a bunch, right?
Yeah, because we're all behind the same IP address, right? So
the whole team was essentially,
we got rate limited real quick.
Yeah, we were essentially blocked. It looked at us and it was like, you guys are doing this too much. So we're going to mm-hmm. put a layman on it.
Take it easy, guys.
Which would be good, except turns out that the way Adam had programmed it was that it was actually a shared pool for everybody in the world. Which means it wasn't just our table. It's just that our studio, by refreshing the site a bunch before it went live,
blocked everyone else in the world.
Which is very hard to debug because we couldn't know. So fortunately, I had the logs open and running while everything was going because I wanted to just like watch things go through and make sure it was happening fine. And I noticed a whole bunch going in at once that were like API limit exceeded over and over and over again. And Sam had been just refreshing it constantly. So I'd been ignoring it for a while, but I was like, Sam, are you still on the site? And he was like, no, I've been doing something else.
I was like, oh shit.
And I was like, this isn't right. And so I dug through it. And I mean, the details don't really matter, but.
My favorite image from this is Adam reaching into the code base and just ripping that out. Like just bloody parts and all, just ripping that rate limiter out.
Turned it all off. And I figured I'll turn it back on. Once, you know,
well, this is a practice that we've sort of taken to heart is to put kill switches on almost all of these kinds of security features and stuff, mm-hmm. just in case they go horribly wrong.
And one of these things we were talking about actually on Thursday was how necessary it seems like it is to have huge steel switches that we bust out for launches mm-hmm. that we just USB plug into our computers.
Like a lever
lever that just takes
throw a fucking switch.
Yeah. So like, okay, this one's attached to the rate limiter. So if that goes wrong, you just
pull that. You just turn it off.
Because how satisfying
would that be? Pretty fun for a launch, especially once GameMaker gets its like build pipelines done and all this kind of stuff. And then we could be like, all right, it's time to publish the next build, right? just throw the switch.
Yep.
We're going to have to do that. It's going to be a thing.
That'd be real cool.
Yeah, we can probably Arduino a thing mm-hmm. where we get a big steel switch, maybe like one of those ones like you see from the old movies when they turn on the electric chair.
Yes,
like
that's exactly what I want.
The big thing on the wall, and they're just like,
yeah, Yeah. And we can get one of those little globe, what are those electric ball thingies is, you
Tesla
know?
Ball.
Little Tesla ball. We can put that on the top so it goes.
I'm digging this plan. But yeah, so the whole point is that Scuffle Buddies announcements went very well, and there's a nice rate of signups
coming
in. Despite
all that stuff.
Do you want to talk about the counter failure? Because that one was, particularly.
Okay, sure. I didn't want to throw all your faults out on the table. I'm totally deaf.
It was mostly my mistakes.
It was.
Entirely? So, exclusively, maybe?
Well, yeah, but I think, there's an entertaining point.
We got to explain this in a high level way because it is a little nitty gritty.
Yeah, the thing is like, it is.
The long and the short of it is the way we had programmed the email counter was tied to how many people were in the newsletter that was going out. Mm-hmm. And the newsletter that's going out, obviously, it's like being in a mail queue. We had 136,000 emails or 135,000 was at the start to send out, which we were including in our counter of people who are signed up for Scuffle Buddies because they are.
Right.
So the problem was that as each email went out, the system was like, oh, I'm not sending that person an email anymore. So it decremented, which meant that every hour, that number that was on the website, which was supposed to show, 1,000 people signing up for the newsletter, was actually going down by about a rate of 1,000 every single hour.
Because of our probabilistic emailing robot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was funny. But I will say we have had a really, really good number of signups since they came out. I think the song's been downloaded like 1,000 times or something now.
I think 2,000 times.
Is it 2,000 times?
2,000, yep.
That's really
it's
cool.
It's a good jam.
It's a good jam. If you haven't checked it out, go to scufflebuddies.com. And if you want just Scuffle Buddies alerts, you can put your email address in there. And you also get the theme music from the song.
And you'll get that from the newsletter if you're already signed up. But if you don't want to wait and you haven't gotten it yet, just go sign up for it.
It's fine. It's an auto email.
So. We'll be checking that email list against the normal BScotchID when we send out emails. So you won't get two of stuff in the future.
And we've also got a couple other cool things came out this past weekend.
What's that?
Adam's Talk. Hit the YouTubes.
Hit the airway. Vacuum
the
tube waves?
The internet tubes.
Vacuum waves.
This is Adam's talk that he gave at Pixel Pop Festival originally, and then we had some video problems.
Yes.
So
we talked about the camera problem.
Yeah. So we got our camera working. Everything is smooth as butter, and the audio turned out manageable despite basically the talk being
Patrick helped us out on that one.
Yeah, basically the talk was in a warehouse next to an air conditioner.
Yeah, which does kick off about halfway through.
That's good.
So the audio does sound way better about 15 minutes in. So
yeah.
It's kind of nice.
But it's about a 35-minute talk, and it's called Thinking. It's Harder Than You Think.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. So I don't want to say too much about it.
It may provoke thoughts.
It might provoke
some
thoughts.
Would say.
At the very least, it'll make you sit back and just go, damn.
So if you want to give it a watch, go to bit.ly/thinking-talk. It's a really easy one, real convenient.
Also, we just put it on our Twitter as well, so you can go over there and look at it.
Yep. Also, I got the fifth episode of my game dev tutorial series up, and this one is about how to do parallax scrolling backgrounds.
Neato.
Which is, it's a much shorter one than the others, so if you've been keeping up with that video series and want to learn more about how game do, then go on over there and watch
learn
that
about
video.
The game do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then last but not least, before we get to some questions, we've been in the midst of a bit of a review drive trying to get, buff up our street cred, our pod cred.
Mm-hmm. Street cred's been a little dull.
People are like, how many stars you got? And it's like Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah.
So if we get 5 stars, it's
then
like
we get
real
arrested.
Good. I think get tanks deployed to come get us.
Yeah.
We just get our own military. No, we get attacked by
a military.
So if you want us to be attacked by the military, go give us 5 stars. bit.ly/CWBApple because we're trying to push them all into iTunes for various reasons.
And so one of the things we wanted to do was to periodically snag some of these reviews.
You guys did not disappoint.
We got a whole bunch. We can't read them all because
otherwise it's all we'd be doing.
That's all we'd be doing. Some of them are very elaborate and hilarious.
So you should go read them.
Read us an excerpt from one of them at least.
Excerpt.
So this review is by Degeki,
who is one of our great podcast questioners.
Mm-hmm.
This is a bit lengthy.
All right.
So brace your loins. All right.
Brace.
The Geki says, are you sad, lonely, or sick of your dead-end life? Well, you're in luck. There are people out there looking out for you. They're called counselors, and they're not involved in this podcast. The good news is that this podcast can still help. Every week, the three brothers Coster come to your device to deliver laughter, life lessons, and a metaphoric crowbar that you can use to break into the gaming industry.
Ooh.
Each podcast chronicles how the brothers approach life and building their entertainment empire one brick at a time, which they then pick up and smash right into your funny bone repeatedly. If you don't walk away from listening to this as a much better person, that's okay, because these guys do this for the funsies, not to force a change on you. But hey, if you want to change, just listen closely and you're bound to hear something you can use to make life less awful. With enough lessons learned here, life might even get good. Ooh. Disclosure, these are not licensed health professionals. Any advice heard here will not improve your grammar. A better life outlook is not guaranteed. There's no liability for bad advice. No financial advice given here should be taken seriously. That funny smell is not the podcast, but probably you, and a shower can usually fix it. This podcast is not to be taken before bed. If you experience headaches or bleeding after listening, you should consult your doctor.
That's definitely true.
I think Degeki may have a future in drug commercials. Right? I'm going to be honest. Uh-huh. Yeah, this is feeling real good.
I feel like I should have read that last part at triple speed, but I just don't really have the, I don't have the diction.
Maybe if Patrick is paying really close attention, he can speed that up real quick.
He can
real
speed
good.
That up. Yeah, so that's, I mean, we've been very humbled by all the fantastic reviews that we've gotten from everybody. So, and every single one is super helpful. We are pushing for 100, which is, you know, it's pretty high goal.
It is a high goal. But I mean, we're closing in already.
And of course,
many more than we had when we first started, which is
and of course
point.
The question is why, which is basically if we want to actually get the podcast featured and promoted in other places,
that demonstrate that people like it.
Yeah. And so that 100 review threshold is sort of it's like a starting point.
It's a magic arbitrary number that we all have collectively agreed that while arbitrary is also magic
and a number. Yeah. All right, so having said all that, let's get on to some questions.
Let's do it.
These questions come from podcast.bscotch.net. They're from our listeners and people and randos on the internet. So let's get started. First question comes from Rampandapus, who says, seems like lots of game developers are using loot crates as part of their monetization strategies. Why are they doing this?
Are they referring to the company Loot Crate specifically or to the concept in general?
The concept. Why are they doing this as opposed to selling the individual items in the crates? This feels like a player hostile practice. Thoughts? So what I want to know is, why is it that only game developers are doing this?
You mean, why can't I go to the car dealership and say, Hey, car dealer, I got $18,000 to drop. I was just going to buy a car.
But I don't want to know.
I don't know which one I want. Or rather, I'll pay you.
Oh, you're talking about the probabilistic loot crate. Okay, yeah. I was thinking of the company Loot Crate that sells merchandise.
Oh, yeah, we should okay. clarify.
This was all very confusing.
Loot Crate, the way, for some reason, many games are doing this now. Overwatch does this, Rocket League.
Overwatch, Hearthstone, it starts with the idea of a card pack. A card pack is what a loot crate is, but in a different form, right? So usually what it is in trading card games, you'll buy just a pack of cards. You don't know what's in it. It's got a wrapper, so you can't see the cards. And when you rip it open, then you are very disappointed or very happy, depending on it, because it's a random reward. Maybe you're just like, this was worth $5.
But the point being, you don't get to decide what you're getting.
Correct.
You're gambling.
It is. So.
Yeah, well, we talked about exactly this a few episodes ago, which I guess I would summarize by saying exactly that.
It's gambling.
And it's bad.
Well, let's talk about why.
And it is player hostile.
Let's talk about why. So, because there's other practices here that don't involve necessarily trading money that are equivalent in terms of their psychological response. And all this comes down to is the fact that when you're conditioning someone to do a thing and trying to get them to, for example, be addicted to playing your game or spending money on it, one of the best things you can do is make it so that the reward is variable and not always guaranteed. So the reality is, if it's the case, for example, with your children, or with your dog. Let's use dogs because it's an easier response for everybody. So if with your dog, every single time it does a particular thing, you give it a treat, it will not work as well from a general conditioning standpoint as if sometimes you don't, sometimes you do. It just works better for whatever reason because of how our brains work. So conditioning works better when the rewards are not guaranteed and are necessarily a bit more sporadic. And then what that looks like in games is if you play something like Diablo, something that has loot, something like Crashlands, for example. Mm-hmm. Every single tree you break open, every creature you break open, there's a random smattering of goods that may or may not appear, as well as some legendary items and stuff. So,
and it's a sliding scale where the reason we do this is because sameness is boring, right? And so if we were like, we made a crafting game where every item in the game is a tree and every tree you break drops one log and then you just build an increasingly
large
increasingly,
wooden thing.
Yeah, you just keep building a wooden chest plate that you know what the stats are going to be. It just has HP on it. And it's basically, you just put one log in to get one more HP.
So even the description is hilarious, right? I mean,
it doesn't... But that's what it would be like to sort of not have the randomization and the surprises.
Right.
So we need that in order for things to be interesting, because we need those surprises.
Yeah. So the question is, there's an ethical question as far as when do you get to use this? And I think this is the part, this is the important part. So this is also a keystone of, so speaking from my own experience, having been in an abusive relationship, this is part of the keystone of how an abusive relationship works. You don't know whether the person's going to be amazing to you that day or horrible.
Yep.
And the thing is that there's an intoxicating effect that happens because of that. In the
it
same
makes
way,
the good stuff seem even better.
Exactly.
You're getting kicked around.
Highs and lows all over the place. And so there is an interesting ethical question with regard, I think, to games generally, which is where is it okay to apply this? Mm-hmm. Where is it okay to put randomness with regard to reward? Because playing a game is its own activity that is done basically for itself, right? There's no point.
Yep.
So the question is, if when you start attaching money to the potentiality of those rewards, is that where we start having an issue? Where's the ethical line here?
I don't think there's a line so much as a spectrum.
It's a gradient.
Yeah. We're sort of...
Well, it's kind of a potential for harm gradient, right?
Sure.
Because the fact is that even a thing that doesn't necessarily suck money out of your wallet, the more fun a thing is, the more time you spend doing it.
Right.
And time has a cost. Mm-hmm. Because you could be... making money, because it's capitalism.
Time
right?
is so money.
Your time is money.
Time is money.
It's just the same thing. Right. So the opportunity cost of anything, of doing anything, not just the financial one, but if you spend time doing one thing, you can't spend it doing something else. Mm-hmm. So the more fun a thing is, the more time you're going to spend doing it. So even if a thing isn't pulling money out of your wallet, if it uses mechanisms that are known to then make you want to keep playing, these sort of addictive kinds of mechanisms, right? Things that are more fun for you, that you get more joy out of, which is why you keep on doing it. Sort of the more intoxicating you make a thing, just like drugs and alcohol, the more dangerous it can get. And so I think it's just kind of and if you now couple that with something like, oh, also we get to pull money out of your wallet.
Right. Now you have a,
you're taking their time, I think, and their money.
Yeah. I think that just bumps you up really far down that scale.
Right. One of those is actually with Rocket League. Because they started doing this crap too.
I stopped buying stuff in Rocket League once they did it.
Well, because they randomly will give you crates. And then you have to buy a key to open the goddamn crate. And the first time I got a crate, I was like, oh, this is neat. And so I bought a key for like $1, $1.50 or something.
Yep. I did the same thing.
Opened it and was disappointed.
Yep.
And I was like, well, why did I do
never
that?
Doing that
I'm
again.
So confused. Yeah. And I was like, if they just let me buy the decal. Well,
the shitty thing is
that I want for my car.
They've clearly put a lot of effort into making a lot of these. Like there's this one 8-bit pixelated rocket trail that you can get. And it actually sounds like it's from a retro video game. Like the sound is all kind of like crunched out, like an 8-bit style sound effect. And it's pixelated, super cool. And it's in a loot crate. Like that's how you get it.
You can't just buy it.
Yeah. Like I would pay like $5 to get that thing for my car and they won't let me. So I'm just not going to.
Yeah.
It's an interesting one. Yeah. So I guess largely, I don't think any of us are particularly on the loot crate train as it's used for money making purposes.
Well, but I think about the purpose of that. Cause you can think about this in the same sense as like a roguelike, where what a roguelike does by having you die permanently on a run is extend the sort of effective lifetime of the game, because you don't just like get to go beat it incrementally, right? You just makes a progress die. And it actually then allows you to have a lot less game and then seem to have a lot more game.
Mm-hmm.
And in a lot of ways, it's a useful design principle if you're trying to make a game and you're restricted on time.
Lets you get more mileage out of your content.
Right. But you take that same principle and apply it to stuff you're trying to sell. Right. Because in this case, like if I want that 8-bit thing, so I'm just going to go gamble on it. Right. Every time I don't get it, now I have to gamble again.
Mm-hmm. It might take you $100 to get it.
Yeah. So now you can have a whole bunch of stuff. So now your content can be on average actually less valuable. But having the more high valuable stuff in there makes people have to spend a lot more money as if everything that they're buying is high value.
Interesting. Well, so I've been doing this in Diablo 3, which I've been playing since the Necromancer came out. And there's this one item I'm trying to get, which requires these 4 rare drops from very rare things out in the world. And it's a compounding randomness problem. So the final piece, which I cannot get, I've spent probably like 4 hours trying to get this thing. You go to an area and there's a 50% chance first that the cave that you want will spawn.
Okay.
Now, if the cave that you want spawns, inside of that cave, there's a 50% chance that the boss creature will spawn.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's like a 5% chance that boss creature will drop the thing. Okay.
It's not great. But I guess you could probably, if the cave isn't there, you can quit and start and try again.
Correct. Okay. So the redo time is like 30 seconds, right?
But it's
so
you run in and crazy that you just have to
do It's just very that. Annoying, especially when you couple with the fact that they have a 10-second timer to make you leave, right? You hit leave game and it just counts down from 10, which if you're trying to do this goofy grinding stuff, it's very annoying.
Just like sit there.
So I've been working on this for, I don't know, probably 3 or 4 hours, like I said, and still haven't gotten it. But the reward is, I know exactly what the reward is. And I do feel like I'm working toward it in the sense that I'm just putting in some time. It's like a fun thing to do.
Yeah, one of these times.
And it's just sort of like, it's my goofy video gaming activity that I'm currently doing, right? Just like when I played Terraria and decided to build that spaceship UFO thing that just like mines the world.
That thing is pretty fucking rad.
Because sometimes it's just kind of fun to do. And
if any of you who play Terraria and haven't seen that thing, you should.
It's incredible.
It's pretty fucking rad. You should YouTube that.
So that's like what, but I've been enjoying that time. I don't feel compelled to go do it.
Well, I think it's because it doesn't feel like you're being exploited.
That's probably what it is.
And well, in a way you are still, but
you know the rules of this thing.
Mm-hmm. I guess if I had to pay like a buck to enter the cave each time.
Yeah. Then you would know you were being exploited.
Right.
Right. Because then you always have to ask the question, well, why? Because right now you can basically be like, well, this is kind of dumb and frustrating, but really what they did is they just coupled a reward on top of the existing game infrastructure, right? Which feels like it makes sense.
It's just, to me, it's a fun extra thing right now.
Yeah.
If I had to pay a buck to get in the cave, nah.
Or what if they removed the cave entirely and just put that thing in a loot crate?
Well, that's an interesting point, though, too.
Because like, it cuts out gameplay.
Well, right? I think this is the thing about a lot of these practices, and there's a great article in Kama Sutra about this, about the data implosion or whatever. Mm-hmm. Basically, the idea is that so much of dev is going into these extractionary mechanisms, loot crates, optimizing, LTV on mobile games.
That's lifetime value.
DARPU, ARPU, all this other
crap.
That's
a
daily average revenue per user.
There's so much mental bandwidth in a company and money from a company standpoint going into extraction methods versus if Rocket League was like
you're drilling for oil.
Yeah. If Rocket League was like, hey, we're going to make a season campaign that you can do, and these rewards are available at these points in that game, and that's it. The AI ramps up over time. It's a single player campaign. They haven't done that yet.
Or if they were like, hey, some of our matchmaking systems and the way that people can just leave matches whatever the fuck they want break multiplayer in this game, maybe we should fix that so that more people want to play the game.
Right. So I think that's actually the frustrating thing to me is that because the even the more annoying problem, so yes, loot crates are basically gambling. But the other thing...
They just are gambling.
But the other thing to me about it is that is dev time.
Yeah.
And that could've is gone dev time that can else. Go to something else. Yep. And so that's always the question for me is, cool.
What did we lose to get this?
Yeah.
To get this
goddamn loot crate. It's crazy.
Yep. Man, I don't like it.
Well, anyway. It also completely removes any satisfaction you could possibly get out of obtaining the thing. It adds a little bit left because of it's a gambling component, mm-hmm. right? But it's not coupled to the game at all.
Right.
So you now, don't do anything to earn it.
You don't do anything.
Have
so now,
money.
Yeah, because it used to be, original vanilla Rocket League, they still had the random unlocks, but it would just be every time you complete a match,
you just get one.
And then you're like, oh, cool. Then you go try it out on your car and see how it looks.
But think about it, because they have those practice sessions. They could say, okay, if you manage to get 10 of the striker goals in a row in the first section, then you get this thing.
Yep.
Because then if you
beat your best time.
Or add an obstacle course.
Right, because then if you the thing, right. The value of those is then that if you see someone with that out in the world.
It means something.
It doesn't mean that they're rich. It means that they're good.
Or you mean that they were rich.
Or that they were rich. Yeah. Anyways, let's move on.
That's like what I think. Anytime I see somebody driving a really nice car around, I'm like, that person used to be rich. Anyways.
And may or may not still be.
Yeah, loot crates, whatever. Pass. Yeah. Hard pass.
But all right.
Not to be confused with the company Loot Crate, which I was originally confused about when we started this thing off.
They're pretty cool.
It's a different thing. Unrelated. They sell merchandise.
It's kind of the same.
I don't think they do gambling stuff.
But they send you random merch.
Yeah. Right?
Ooh, it actually is random, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you don't know what you're going to get.
That's true.
How come?
Anyway, we don't need to go down that rabbit hole.
But you also don't know what the pool of available things is, right?
True.
That's probably the difference. Because that's genuinely like, yeah, give me something fun. That's like when you go to a restaurant, you're like, I don't know, bring me whatever's good.
Yeah.
That's like what Loot Crate is.
Yeah. It's a different not the equivalent kind of intention. Crate.
Yes. Or like a blue apron.
Blapron.
Like you're going to pay them every week and they're just going to send you random ingredients. You have no idea what's coming.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You're going to cook. But that's what you want.
Because
you're going to eat all of it, yes. And you just want food. So it's going to serve your purpose. all right, next question comes from Kayul. When developing your games, do you prefer tile-based collisions or instance collisions? This is a bit of a technical question here.
What does it mean?
All it means is, in a game world, you often have a grid.
Okay.
You can take, you know, pixel XY coordinates. You can turn those into a grid.
So like graph paper situation.
Yeah.
Cool.
And so you can basically, let's say you have 50 objects in the world and they each have different shapes. And you have your little character and you want to ask the question, is my character like banging up against these shapes? So that like maybe it's a bullet, maybe it's a like a piece of ground to walk on. A
bullet is one of the most painful shapes to bump up.
It's bullet shape.
Yeah.
And so the question is basically, how do you calculate that? Like what's the code that you use to ask that question? So with an instance collision, your little player character will actually check where it is and then its own shape and then compare that to where everything else is and those shapes.
To see if they overlap.
To see if they overlap. And if so, then it'll do whatever it's supposed to do.
It'll be like, fuck, I've collided.
You're like, I got bulleted, right? Yeah. And so that's more expensive because it basically requires every time the game updates, which is usually 60 times per second, right? 60 frames per second. Every time the game updates, it has to ask that question. Everything has to ask everything else. Hey, where are you? And are you bumping into me?
Yeah, it's like, are we overlapping in space right now?
Yeah.
Right.
So the advantage of...
Hey, Bullet, are you inside me?
Yep.
Am I supposed to be dying?
Am I dying?
Hey, Bullet! The Bullet's like, yeah, man, you're so dead.
Yeah,
man, you're...
Yeah, this is bad.
You're gone. So, looks real bad in here. There's blood everywhere.
It's not looking good, buddy.
So tile-based collisions are basically taking advantage of the fact that you have this grid. And so you'll have sort of like, let's say you have like a piece of terrain, like a block that you can walk on. And that block will store some information at a grid location. So then as a player, you can just, instead of checking every block in the world, you can just look where your feet are and check like, hey, at this XY place, is there a block there? And it's just a checking one single thing, which is yes or no. And if it's yes, then you're like, ah, I'm going to stand here.
So right? You do the same thing if there's a bullet there too.
Yeah.
Right. You're like, hey, grid space that I'm on, is there a bullet here with me also?
So this is the tricky thing is tile collisions work pretty well for static things like terrain or something like that. When it comes to bullets and stuff like that, it's a lot tougher because they tend to have...
Do you mix and match?
You got to mix and match.
Okay, so you use the tile-based collisions for
environments, static things.
Stuff that can be cheap.
And if you notice in Crashlands, we have a combination. So for example, like you'll see a tree or a rock or something like that, and you cannot walk on the grid space that tree is on.
It's why all the art is done to fill.
Yeah. So the whole tree, like we don't actually check the tree's collision with the player's collision. We check the grid space that the tree is on. Cause the tree has just said, hey, you can't walk here.
You can't go here, buddy.
Hey, I'm tree in here. So you can't go there, right? And this is also why, for example, if in Crashlands, you can do this experiment where you take two walls and you place them corner to corner. So there's like a diagonal space.
Yeah.
And you can walk right between them because you can just make that little pixel jump between in that little area between the grid spaces.
It is kind of tricky to pull off though. So you usually can't.
Yeah.
But sometimes
it can. Used to be much easier in the beta.
It used to be much easier.
Yeah. People were squeezing into all sorts of places. Yeah.
so we were like, is this a problem? I don't know, whatever.
Close enough.
Yep. And so it just kind of depends on, you know, if you're making it for weaker devices and stuff like that, those tile collisions are real nice to use. But yeah, so there's a little technical aside.
Mm-hmm.
Our next question comes from Wolam 77. Do you think that game devs should take into consideration streamers and where they put their camera/bust shot while streaming when they design game UIs? So should we make a little corner, like a little Nestle area?
That's actually interesting.
You could even have a UI setting.
I was going to say, that's all you should do.
Yeah.
But then that what about
your stuff slightly?
Scale. Because some people like having their face bigger than other people.
What I was thinking we could do is actually when a streamer plays, we put in like a separate game mode, right? Where they can overlay their face just like onto everything.
All the characters have their face.
Yeah.
All of the weapon slots have their face.
Yeah. Cause I mean, why just rearrange the UI? You know, why don't we
just make it all about the streamer?
Get in there.
I mean, as far as I understand, they're the content creators.
Yeah,
right.
It's true.
Like, it's not us. We're sort of subservient to the stream, to the our Lord and Savior, the streamers.
Right. Yep.
And so we should probably just go ahead and instead of doing this little like nod to their existence, we should just acknowledge the fact that they basically own us, and everything that we do should probably
That particular viewpoint does speak to a larger, interesting sort of feel that a lot of game devs have, because it is weird that like you spend all this time making a game for example, you know, 2 years.
You're behind the scenes.
You're behind the scenes the whole time. And that it's totally possible using affiliate links now for something like Amazon with Twitch, for streamers to get paid like a buck per copy of your game or something like that, which is, I think the only reason it's a weird fairness thing, because it's like, I spent the last 2 years of my life making this and I get 10 of the dollars and you get one of them, right? And it's like,
because you played it for 30 minutes.
It's like, ah. But I do totally get it, because there's a ton of added value that comes from that.
Streaming is very hard.
Oh yeah, we've done it a few times. It's brutal. I don't know how people do it for
nobody should assume that we don't respect the amount of work talent that goes into being a good streamer, because it's incredibly difficult.
Yeah. And I do think there's a lot to say for making it easier for people to stream, because I do think it's another one of those platform things, right? So we've talked about making a game feel native on PC or on mobile or whatever else requires sort of rethinking some of the UI elements. And that is actually a very good point.
You want it to feel native on Twitch.
Yeah. And why not? That's a really good idea, actually. I haven't been thinking about it.
Or even trying to figure out ways to, because a lot of games use like Twitch API plugins and stuff like that, so that people can chat and, you know, weird things happen.
Right.
So, you know, I think there are some games that are specifically going out of their way to accommodate streamers and their communities and stuff like that, which is something we just haven't had that conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
and I think it is also important to remember with all of this that I'm completely unaware of any examples, if they do exist, where streaming has sold more copies of a game than like the platform did itself. Right. Mm-hmm. So, which is basically just a long-winded way of saying, streamers might actually contribute to a bunch of your sales, but they are not the dominant source of your sales. Right. And so if you're trying to make a decision about how do I design my game, given that streaming might contribute to its success.
Yeah, it's a component of the marketing.
Well, sure. Don't design it as if like that's the thing that will make it successful, because you don't want to guide all of your design decisions based on one of the mechanisms by which people will find access.
Well, I would also point out that I believe this to be true, but I understand that this is a bit of a assumption, which is if you look at the top streamers, they tend to play a specific game. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that those communities are largely also already players of that game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so the streamers who play lots of variety of things, they tend to not be the top ones. Right. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, like they make it like 1,000 or something like that views at a time. Yeah.
It's interesting. It is different on YouTube. That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, because people use that as a game discovery mechanism, mm-hmm. I think, more so than live streaming on Twitch and so on.
Yeah. Good point, Woland.
Mm-hmm.
Think about it.
Good idea. Our next question comes from Kulibula, who says, lots of the books you guys recommend say persistence is a good thing.
Mm.
So, Seth, any chance of a Terrain Perlin noise tutorial? I know it would be the
nice
best
one.
Oh,
I know it would be the best and most comprehensible one in the world.
Why don't you do that for your next game dev series?
For anyone who hasn't been listening to this for a long time, this question has been asked on many occasions.
Rather, because like, the thing is, you can't do this verbally in a podcast in no way that would anybody be able to follow, nor be of interest. So why don't you do a YouTube tutorial for
yourself? Yeah, I could do that. My only worry of doing a tutorial is, so it was hard for me to figure out Perlin noise, because so many tutorials get caught up in the details. Like they have all these crazy formulas and all this insane looking math that if you're not a mathematician, you're looking at all these symbols. Most people use unbelievably terrible variable names. They'd be like, all right, so the height is A. Like, what? That doesn't
just fucking call it height.
Use an H.
You're using a computer.
Use the word, use height, you know, so they end up with this just incomprehensible pile of garbage code. And as I was looking through that, I got so caught up in trying to understand those formulas that I ended up just failing repeatedly.
Mm.
And it wasn't until I just started going and trying to find basically the lowest amount of detail tutorials possible so that I could understand the general idea. And then once I did that, I just made up my own implementation, right? And my only concern with making a tutorial is that it would by nature just be a lot more in depth, because I'd be doing it through Game Maker or whatever. And I may end up just making it worse for people because I get so caught up in the details. I gave like a lecture or something like
that. Right, but it's basically the core concept is of using the fact that random numbers that random numbers are seemingly random, but actually are not.
Right.
And using that to generate a consistent, seemingly random pattern.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's how it works. And I think you ought to be able to make like the stupidest, most uninteresting, you know, random terrain possible just by basically using like, cause we just remade like the, which is the Mersenne Twister algorithm or whatever. One of the ones that makes random numbers. Mm-hmm. So we use that in Crashlands to make it cross platform compatible. So you could just basically have that. That just gives you your string of numbers, right?
Yeah.
And then just move along it.
Yeah.
Because that now, that is how it works. And then the details are exactly how you implement it for what you need to do. So I think you could put together
It would probably start with just a few minute, listen, here's the idea.
Yeah.
And here's how this whole thing works. And then get into the nitty gritty and then stepping out.
Yeah. Because actually, I mean, the Perlin noise is, it's very simple once.
It's not that complicated.
The idea is basically you've got static, right? So if you like, if every pixel is random, like random between white and black, right? That's static, right? Now, what if you just stretch that? There, that's Perlin noise,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Like makes perfect sense.
Just stretch it out. You stretch it out so that like instead of every pixel, it's like every 10th pixel is randomly white or black. And then you just fill in the blanks in between mm-hmm. so that like it smoothly goes from one to the next.
Well, I think given that this is one of the most requested game dev
tutorials,
you might just be next on your list.
Try to come up with some sort of a, you know, drill down method, right? Start like really high level, maybe implement something really stupid that just kind of shows.
Well, now we got this ideas. Video camera. I could probably do it on the whiteboard first.
Actually, that's true.
And then move into GameMaker.
That's true.
So it'd be like a 2-part video.
Mm-hmm. Done. All right, cool. All right. You get your dang wish.
Because I know what I'm doing this entire weekend. All right, next question.
You better enjoy it.
Next question comes also from Kulabula.
Dang.
Who says, he's very persistent. Who says,
I want a video. Seriously, let's go.
With your next game, you will be having the same launch day for all platforms, or will you launch on Steam first? As Steamers don't know cross-platform dev exists because you're either a PC game or a damn dirty mobile port and nothing else is possible.
Yeah, I think
that is true.
Our goal still is simultaneous launch and everything. Who knows what's going to happen, but that is the goal at this point in time. And the reason I'm couching it is because there's all sorts of crazy crap that could go down that we could.
We might accidentally launch, you know, 7 days before our launch date.
Yeah. These things happen.
And
yeah.
Who knows what will happen?
Maybe the game will get leaked like Game of Thrones.
As I feel like we tried to illustrate with the Scuff Buddies announcement stories from this morning, as much planning as we do,
everything goes wrong.
Everything goes wrong. So,
but even when it comes to the plan, we may decide to try doing some sort of a staggered launch this time. Mm-hmm. Who knows? I think at this point it is fair to say that we highly, highly doubt it'll be any of those long staggered launches like a lot of things do. At least when it comes to our core platforms that we're already on. The other ones, because those usually take a much larger investment, might still have that long stagger if we do them, but.
Yeah, if anything, it would actually just be because our dev team is still small. And that means that if it's the case, for example, say the game is actually as successful as we want it to be on each platform, we will crush ourselves under the weight of that. So that's just something that we're going to have to make the call on as we get close and say, how well has our marketing been going? What's the fervor look like for this game actually coming out? Because there are still only a few of us butterscotches in the world and we like living.
Well, and there's also, an aspect of this game that may or may not happen, which is multiplayer.
Mm-hmm.
And if it does happen, then
that opens up a can of wigglies.
That opens up a lot of wiggles. And we may need to do some various kinds of like soft launching strategies and kinds of stuff to test out infrastructure, make sure things are working, all that kind of stuff. So there are various kinds of even just technical scenarios outside of marketing scenarios where we might want to do some sort of a staggered launch.
Mm-hmm.
Because at least so far it's been the case that our audiences on each platform are about the same size. So it's just a bunch of people.
Right.
And so we can basically deploy it all at once or deploy it, you know, one over N each time and be able to.
We just don't want an Era 37 situation with Diablo, you know?
Yeah.
We want to avoid.
Yep. Well, I have one strategy that we could take.
All right, hit me.
Is actually just keep developing the game sort of in perpetuity.
Never launch it.
Wait until the industry consolidates enough that it's all just one platform, right? Mm-hmm. So instead of launching it on iOS and Android and Steam and GOG and
whatever.
Xbox and all these things, we'll just launch it on the one overlord platform, you know, the steamy X-Cube
station. I think it's just going to be the Facebook blimp. Is probably where
the face blimp.
The face blimp.
Yeah. What is every game is on face blimp, and that's just that's just the way it is now.
Yeah.
You know, that's the world of 2039.
Yep.
So that's that's a sort of a backup plan.
Yeah.
All right. Next question comes from Brug, who says, he says, what are your greatest inspirations?
Air, mostly.
I knew that was nitrogen. That's the greatest.
That is
one.
The greater
it's about
part.
70%.
But I think like oxygen is the greatest among them.
Say, does it count as breathing it? Since you just breathe it back out, you know, like I mean, don't use it.
It went in there though.
It went in there,
but then it came back out.
Yeah,
but you know
that's true of everything.
But like,
if it's oxygen, it went in for a while before it came back out. And then it came back out as pee, which is kind of,
It's kind of gross, you know, it's kind of weird.
It goes out as carbon dioxide.
Greatest.
It gets molecular'd.
Yeah.
Greatest inspiration.
It gets molecular'd.
I think a big part of it, and part of the reason for doing, this is another part of the reason actually for doing the announcement, is I think people, until you've been making a project and get to show it to an audience who has a reaction, I think you don't understand the amount of fire that it also gives you as a creator to go work on it some more. It's just so exciting to announce a project at any stage, as well as like release new information about whatever else, when the fan response is something, at least some, hopefully not something negative, but something. So I think for me in particular, I think I've gotten to a place, I mean, because the thing is we had enough success with Crashlands where we hit a few of the tiers that we didn't think we would hit for a while. We've now given a talk at GDC. We've done the DICE. We got nominated for a DICE award. And we have a joke, which is the windowsill in our one window in our basement office is covered with all of our second place trophies right now.
Mm-hmm. It's our second place windowsill.
Yeah. So we've never won any award for anything, but we have gotten second place quite a bit. And mm-hmm. I think that
aside from our Game of the Year awards from various,
well, yeah, I mean,
from
like various publications. Not physical things. Yeah,
we didn't get any trophies.
They didn't send us any trophies for that.
We can't put that on the window.
We gotta make
and
our
as own. We all learned from gym class and from sports. The only thing that matters is trophies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
and we don't have any.
We're millennials. So, you know, I don't understand anything unless I get a trophy for it.
Yeah.
That's right.
Got to get that pat on the back.
Yeah. We didn't even get participation ribbons.
That's true.
Because if we had that, then actually we would be fine. Mm-hmm. We would just make terrible things.
Yep.
Yep.
And it would be fine. We'd be happy because we have a participation.
Because we got that ribbon.
Yeah. So I think a big part of the inspiration now is sort of, it's coming twofold actually with the second stage of the studio. One is being able to actually announce our games to a waiting fan base, which has been shown to be actually the case from the Scuffbuddies launch. Because people are excited to see.
It's inspiring.
It's very inspiring to see people be like, we're really excited to see what you guys do with
and
this.
We're like, yes, let's do this. Yes.
And then there's all the people who are like, what about Crashlands 2? And we're like, shut up with that. We're not ready yet. Just hang on.
We want to get better at game stuff.
So there's always that in there. But I think that's been really inspiring, honestly, to see. And then the other piece is actually from the studio growth side, because it was just the three of us. Now it's the seven of us. And I feel like we've been making big strides on the management side. We've been making big strides on the production side as far as how to even work with multiple people who can contribute to a game. And so honestly, it's also just the team that we've assembled is routinely inspiring. I mean, Sher was here over the weekend, like we're doing, working on some porting stuff for Crashlands, doing a big important project that we just kind of have been putting off. Came on the weekend to go do this, and he hung out with Seth.
The whole weekend.
They had a good time, got some new robot arms put up, assigned to their monitors and stuff, you know, all sorts of weird stuff. But I think the point is that the ideal, I think, for us here is that we get to a point where just the daily work is sort of feeding into the inspiration for working on stuff. Mm-hmm. And with a game that starts becoming more crowd-facing, that's easier to do. Because we get those little tidbits where people are like, oh, I listened, we got a tweet from someone like, oh, I've been listening to the song on repeat while I'm drawing. Because it's just, like, it's a good jam. And that feels good. We put a good jam out there, like Patrick did.
Patrick did, so.
Good job, Patrick.
On our behalf.
We looked at it and stuff beforehand. Yep. I feel like we contributed
a lot. We made some inane commentary about it that he interpreted very well.
we're like, make it more music-y. Put some more music in there.
Yeah.
Which just reminded me of the recent happenstance where we were talking about kind of what this theme song would look like, how it might play on the name Scuffle Buddies, you know? And so Sam told Patrick, he's like, I've kind of this like jingle that I've been kind of singing. and so you know, maybe we could kind of like go use that somehow. And Patrick's like, okay, yeah, let me hear this. Just send me a recording of it. And so Sam did. So I just heard him, you know, singing really weird shit, you know, off in the corner. And sent that up to Patrick, and Patrick replied, that was
interesting.
That was interesting. so, you know, he handles us pretty well.
Yeah, I think so. But I think that's the goal, and I feel like we're getting closer to that point. And then I feel like with Scuffle Buddies in particular, that whole, it really just feels good to get that feedback from the crowd and have people be like, yes, we want to see what this is, and have us be like, yes, soon. When it looks good, we're ready to rock. Mm-hmm. So I find a lot of inspiration in that.
Me too. Okay. Next question comes from Anonymous. This is mostly for Sam. Mm. Been learning Inkscape, and I'm having trouble coming up with my own unique art style. Like Sam, I'm beginning with little experience in art. Just curious, how did you go from being inspired by Edmund McMillan's style to your own unique style? How get good?
Oh, it's just a volume game. Literally just a volume
game. Yeah, just at some
point. Don't try to develop a style. Just try to make stuff. Yeah.
Well, so actually the first thing I did was I made stick figure comics.
That's true.
Yeah. And
they existed.
They existed.
They might still even.
They got the idea across of whatever they were trying to do, very much in pictographic caveman style.
What was that website?
I'm not going to say
I know what it is.
I'm not going to say
it. Does it still exist?
It does still exist.
I know, but I will. I feel like I've done enough harm with talking about Sam's book, which is.
Are you talking about the poetry book?
Yeah. No.
The one available on Amazon.com called Metaphorgasm.
Yeah, we've talked about that book enough, so we don't need to go into that.
Don't bring up my comic stint. Okay, so.
We were all young ones.
I started making those stick figures, and that was very much rudimentary stuff. And then it was doing game jams with Seth. And the requirement there was you have to produce a volume of art in 48 hours, which let me move the style forward. But everything was still, and then keep in mind, like if you look back at Towel Fight, everything was very much not good for a very long period of time. And it wasn't until midway through Quadrupus, which was probably, you know, putting in 50, 60 hour weeks for 6 months straight, that the art started occasionally making a thing that I was like, that actually looks pretty nice.
Nailed it.
The urchin, we've talked about this before, the urchin in Quadrupus was the first thing that I made where it just looked really good.
Mm-hmm. And then that depth charge.
And then the depth charge came after that. And Seth asked me, he was like, did you just get this off the internet?
Sam sent me.
I was like, fuck you, buddy.
It was a fair question. Yeah, I mean, he just sent me a picture of the depth charge with no other context. Yeah. He just sent it to me. And I was like, oh, that's cool. We should make something like that for the game.
Yeah.
I'm like, I already did make it for the game. Oh, shit.
And you're like, where is it?
This is it. Oh,
yeah. So I think it's really just a volume game. And then just learning how to step back, or I guess picking small enough projects that, because your style is going to develop really rapidly at the beginning in particular, small enough projects that you can break from the shitty stuff that you're making early on. So in other words, if you're working on a project for like a year this early on, you're going to be trapping yourself stylistically. And we even had this happen with Crashlands toward a bit. The style sort of was definitely trying to evolve a little bit toward the end, but we actually had to kind of put it in stasis a bit. And so with Scuffle Buddies, we're pushing some of the stylistic elements that we started pushing at the end of Crashlands, but couldn't really capitalize on. So make small enough projects that you can jump and you can break from the past routinely, I guess.
Make small projects that you can finish and move on, mm-hmm. and just constantly
just
be
a
making
shitload of things.
Yeah, and every now and then you'll just see these things. Like one time, Sam, we'd been using black shadows on everything.
Mm-hmm.
One time, Sam accidentally clicked on like red or something.
Yeah, he's if you're using Inkscape, all the colors are down there by one another.
I was like, oh shit, colors, shadows can actually be a color.
Mind blown.
That changes everything, right?
It's incredible.
So just, and the thing is like, if he hadn't been sitting there doing art all day, he wouldn't have accidentally clicked that thing, right? Mm-hmm. So it's basically just, you'll find these accidents, you'll discover things. Yeah. So just, you got to keep your eyeballs open and your hands busy. All right. Next question comes from Farseer.
Mm.
When you're basing a game on a concept rather than a feel, Flop Rocket versus Crashlands, how do you know that it's the game you should build? Especially when your brain pumps out new concepts daily. Any easy ways to quickly sift the crap? So this is something that I think a lot of creative people struggle with because they get so fixated on ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a saying in house, which is that there's no such thing as a good game idea. There's only a good execution of a game idea. And if you want any proof, just look at literally any game jam, mm-hmm. because there's a theme which mm-hmm. generally will, it'll often suggest a sort of a play style or a feel or something like that. And the range of games in terms of quality and scope and fun and everything that comes out of a game jam when you've got like 50 games coming out, it's from like zero to perfectly polished and commercially viable, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's easy to think, like, if your game just isn't turning out well, it's easy to sit there and think, well, it's because the idea isn't that good, right? That's a cop out. It's really because you haven't executed it, right? And so you have to keep slogging through.
You have to put its head in that little block thing, and you have to drop that giant blade.
That's right. Wait, that's murder.
We're talking about execution. Right?
Oh, right. Yeah. Oh, right. It's justified murder. My bad.
Yeah.
Correct. You got to execute it. Yeah. So we actually have this design process that we call the diagonal slice, coming back to murder, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's the diagonal slice where basically we have a general sort of vague idea of all the things that we want to be in the game. We start with whatever is sort of like the most obvious game system. We put it in, we add content, and then we balance it out until the game feels pretty fun. Then we add the next game system, which literally breaks everything and makes the game terrible mm-hmm. again. Then we add more content and then polish it up and balance stuff until it becomes fun again. And then we just keep re-breaking the game over and over and over mm-hmm. again. And so if you were to just sort of like arbitrarily pick a date throughout the development of Crashlands, I would say at least half of the time you would be playing a terrible, shitty garbage game, right? But then you just got to keep grinding away at it and keep pulling the levers and twiddling with all the variables and stuff and just brainstorming constantly of ways to improve what you have. And then, you know, it comes out.
Well, I think it's also the thing is there is a skill in recognizing when you've even landed on a concept that's really interesting too. Because when it comes to like, if you're just describing the game to someone and they get kind of excited about it, then that's actually oftentimes a good signal that even if you're having trouble with the gameplay itself, right, the balance or polish or whatever else, then it might be something to pursue because it has some sort of marketing legs to it.
Yeah.
If you're like, hey.
And that's where the idea has power is.
Yes.
Like if it's easy to market and talk about it.
Exactly. You know, so there are some execute, games. Though. Yeah, you still got to execute, but there are some game ideas that they're just not going to fly. Be interesting. But then again, that game Genital Jousting came out. Who would have thought? But the execution, fantastic.
Yeah.
Shockingly.
Fantastic in a very particular kind
honestly,
of way.
Honestly, even games like Nidhogg.
Yeah.
Like, all right, so you got, there's two people, you sword fight each other, and you're just trying to get to one end of the map and get eaten by a worm, mm-hmm. right?
Weird.
Could be utter
horrible.
Garbage.
Right.
But they just nailed every piece of it, mm-hmm. right? So yeah, I mean, you just gotta keep moving forward. Mm-hmm. And it's easy to look at your bad, not fun, boring game and not take responsibility for its state and instead blame the underlying idea, but you just gotta keep going, mm-hmm. keep pushing ahead. All right, so that's all the time we have for this week. We'd like to thank our studio wrangler, Monique, for putting this episode together, our producer, Fat Bard, for making us sound good, and the B-Scotch dev team, Andy, Tifa, and Sher, for continuing to build stuff while we're in here doing the podcast. Special thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord and forums running. And of course, we'd like to thank you, our listeners, for coming back every week to listen to this podcast. If you'd like to get more involved in the Butterscotch community, you can hop into our Discord server at bit.ly/BSDiscord. Come say hi. It's been really hopping the past mm-hmm. week since the Scuffle Buddies announcement. We've had consistently like 200 people in there
yeah.
just yammering like a flock of seagulls.
Well, like 10 of them yammer. The rest are lurking.
Mm-hmm.
They're sort of yammer lurking.
Yeah. But you know. You do you. You know, we all start as lurkers and then some of us yammer.
That's yep. True. Some of us evolved into ultra lisks. Also, we also have a mailbox. So if you'd like to send us candy, maybe a letter with a little bit of, you know, a little bit of cologne or some perfume or something squirted on there to make it nice, make it more personal.
Sentimental.
A little more sentimental.
Mm-hmm.
You can do that. We have a mailbox. It's at mailbox.bscotch.net. So go there and then send us crap.
We also have a e-box now.
E-box.
Mm-hmm. Also known as an email. Address. We talked about this in the last episode because we were like, hey, tell us about something. And then we realized that you had no mechanism to do that. So we've temporarily and experimentally set up an email inbox because we don't know what you maniacs are going to send there.
What is it?
It's podcast@bscotch.net. So, you know.
So the website is podcast.bscotch.net. Because
mm-hmm, that's a website.
The email is podcast@bscotch.net.
Yeah, super easy.
Don't get your wires crossed.
Nope, because then nothing bad will happen. So you got to be real careful.
Right.
But yeah, so you can send an email that way.
Will be nothing.
Nope. We will definitely read them, especially right now because we probably won't have all that many. And we won't definitely respond, but we will definitely read them. We'd love to hear what you think.
That's right. Also, as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, we are in the midst of a review push. So we do depend on those reviews to be able to promote the podcast. So if you are listening on Apple Podcasts, you can help us out by going to bit.ly/CWBApple. Leave us 5 stars. And we would appreciate that tremendously. And who knows, if your review is amazing enough, it may end up being on the podcast. Mm-hmm. So thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.